Welcome to Not Artificially Sweetened, a weekly podcast where we reflect on all things diabetes. Your hosts are specialist physician Stan Landau and diabetes specialist nurse Michael Brown. We are passionate about using our talents to change lives for the better. Our mission is to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Nothing is off the table here as we discuss real people, their real issues and stories, and together discover real answers to many vexing practical issues in diabetes and its management. And here we go again. Welcome to episode 44 of Not Artificially Sweetened. We're so glad to be back with you again. And as usual, in studio with me, Dr. Stan Landau.
Hello, everybody. And thanks, Michael. A big thank you to our listeners for having joined us in the past on our favorite platforms such as Spotify, Pocket Casts, the Apple Podcasts, Podbean Plus, Listen. Thanks, everybody. Give us a shout out, like us, and share widely on your social media. Remember that you can continue to send in questions, thoughts, and comments to our email, podcast@cdediabetes.co.za.
So Stan, you brought in one of our new portals, and we're very excited to bring to our listeners' attention Listen. Listen is a South African-based app which brings together a whole lot of different media projects in one place. It's absolutely amazing looking at the Listen platform. It brings together South African terrestrial radio stations like Jozi FM and Hot 102.7, together with a whole variety of podcasts going from Moneyweb Business with Jeremy Maggs, True Crime, including American Scandal and My Favorite Murder. And we are so grateful and honored to be included in their top podcast picks. So please check out Listen. It's a great app. It's downloadable free from iOS or Android Play Stores. No sign up or sign in is required. It means anyone can access it at any time. And you can personalize your listening experience as well. Not Artificially Sweetened podcast is known for our unique and no-holds-barred approach to democratizing diabetes care and education. And we are now proudly available on this innovative Listen mobile app.
It's nice to see, Michael, that the podcast itself is maturing. And, you know, on the same theme, I get the sense from the message from SA Diabetes Advocacy this week that their organization is maturing too. You know, in the early days, you had this kind of grassroots movement gaining momentum. They've had two big summits at this point in time. But I think the message this week is a very interesting one because for me, it really brings home the idea that they are taking off in terms of their good project work. And we're now seeing that really building upon these big ideas that they have, getting them actually on the ground running at this point. And I wonder if this isn't a good time to take a short break and listen to this week's message.
Great. Let's listen to it.
SA Diabetes Advocacy's next focus project for 2024 is a counseling social worker support project. In 2023, we connected with the Red Cross Children's Hospital Diabetes Clinic, where we were told that one of the biggest needs is access to a counseling social worker. Many of these young children living with diabetes are exposed to gang violence, gender-based violence, poverty, and food scarcity. This exposure is impacting their diabetes care because other issues are not being dealt with adequately. We have worked year-long on this project and look forward to a counseling social worker starting at the clinic in 2024. There will be a study attached to this project to determine if there are improvements to HbA1c levels and diabetes distress scores with the intervention of a counseling social worker. For more information on projects that SA Diabetes Advocacy is working on, please visit diabetesadvocacy.org.za.
Thank you once again, Kirsten, from SA Diabetes Advocacy. As we said just before playing this clip, we really are seeing a great maturing in diabetes advocacy in South Africa, and this is very positive for our future outcomes.
It's an interesting message in that podcast message. She spoke about the poverty that lies in the areas around the Cape Flats and the feeder areas to the Red Cross Hospital. And it's interesting when you take a broader view on the deprived socioeconomic communities. One of the things we're beginning to see a lot more of is gout in those communities. We also see a lot of gout in our day-to-day clinical practice. Now, for those of you who are healthcare providers, the typical teaching back in the day for gout was the overweight English squire who consumed pints of beer and ale and was eating steak and kidney pies and organ meats. Mm-hmm. And whilst that may still in part be true in certain population groups, we're seeing more and more gout, in fact, in poorer and poorer communities. And one of the reasons for that is the increased consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages, fruit juices as well. And people often don't perceive those non-animal-based products as being a potent cause of gout. And it's very important because there's a lot of work being done globally at the moment on the negative impact that fructose or fruit-based sugars can have on the promotion of gout. And whilst consumption of sugar-sweetened beverages in richer countries in the so-called developed world are in fact reducing steadily over time, those in the less advantaged communities are actually seeing an increase in consumption, and they're the most vulnerable. So gout is still an important clinical entity we see in diabetes medicine, often seen as a single, hot, red, swollen joint, and is easily treated. But dare I say that for many people with diabetes, be careful when you go to your pharmacist and are given a gout bomb cocktail, because they almost always contain anti-inflammatory medications. And whilst anti-inflammatory medications are great at putting the fire out, they can have most detrimental effects on the kidney. And because people with diabetes are often on blood pressure-lowering medications and diuretics, which may render them vulnerable for kidney damage, the inclusion of an anti-inflammatory as part of a gout bomb can be a pretty dangerous thing. And week after week in clinical practice, we will see people whose kidney function has dropped off sharply. You only have to ask a question about pain relief, and there it comes up. So just a word of caution, be mindful with the medications you're given over the counter, particularly if you're vulnerable from a kidney point of view. So, Michael, gout isn't a historic Victorian England condition. It's a very real South African condition. And as we've spoken about in this podcast before, pain is a very common complaint we see in day-to-day practice.
Absolutely, Stan. Thanks for bringing that to our collective attention. I wanted to talk about another common thing we see often on our 24-hour hotline. I'm of the firm belief that no diabetes center can function properly without a 24-hour hotline support service, and this is something we do offer to our clients. A common situation we come across is someone would phone and say, my blood glucose is 22, I'm thirsty, I'm not feeling well. And we'd say to the person, well, how long has this been going on? Just a day or so. And what were your blood glucoses before that? Well, they were 18. It's amazing how people set a line in the sand where their maximum target blood glucose should be maybe no more than 8 to 10, but they decide for themselves that their target line in the sand is 18, and they will only respond when it goes over that. And that brings us to a concept called normalcy bias. This describes our tendency to underestimate the possibility of bad things happening to us, of disaster, and we think that life is just going to continue as normal, even in the face of significant threats or crises. What you also said, Stan, I think in the previous episode, was that many people don't check their blood glucose for many weeks, so that when they do eventually get around to check it, they get a fright. And that's another form of normalcy bias, or in fact, we could call it the ostrich effect or denial, where we choose to blind ourselves to things that make us feel uncomfortable. This normalcy bias is closely linked to another bias called the optimism bias, and this is our tendency to overestimate our likelihood of experiencing positive events and to underestimate our likelihood of experiencing negative effects. A great business case for this kind of bias was seen with Blockbuster. Now, remember, Blockbuster Video was a huge empire that used to rent out videos, and they turned down an offer to buy Netflix back in the early 2000s. They looked at Netflix's potential disruption of the video rental market by offering a mail order movie rental service. And they said, that's not going to break the mold. We are the king of the heap and nothing's going to change. And you know what? They rejected the deal. And within 10 years, they were gone, unable to cope with a new way of doing things. In diabetes, we need to understand that most of the time we are going to feel well, and that's good. That's what we're aiming to do with all our clients who have diabetes. We want them to feel well much of the time. But we don't want anyone to fall into that habit of normalcy bias where, well, I feel well, so therefore I am well, therefore there's nothing I need to do. Last year, I discussed my passion for self-defense, martial arts, and a very well-known teacher in this area was Colonel Jeff Cooper. He was a U.S. Marine, and he's largely credited for the rise of the modern handgun teaching movement. And he talked about levels of awareness, four basic levels, condition white, which means total unawareness. You go through your life not being aware of anything. And in fact, that's where the normalcy bias tends to reside. And if you do that, it's actually the most dangerous way of living possible, because you don't see threats coming until too late. He said a better way of living was to live in condition yellow, which is a state of relaxed awareness. Let's make an analogy to driving. When you get in your car, you drive, you're not panicked, you're not stressed, but as you've been taught in your driving training, you are continually checking your rearview mirror, you're checking left, right, before you turn, and so on. And that helps you to see and to predict any dangers that come. The next condition is condition orange, where you've got a specific alert and that's triggered your full attention. So you've maybe seen someone pulling out in front of you, you're getting ready to brake hard or to turn, but obviously at the same time, you've checked your rearview mirror to see that you can actually turn or veer safely. Again, we'd said last year, the best way to win a fight is to not get into one, to run away. The next stage is condition red, where you actually are faced with a decision to either defend your life, to fight, or to flee. The final stage, which was identified by the US Marine Corps subsequent to Jeff Cooper's four stages, was that of black, where you immobilize by panic or fear. And that's not where you want to get to. So let's put that into diabetes perspective. So condition white, total unawareness. We carry on our lives. We don't check our blood glucose. We're totally unaware of where we are with respect to our daily health. We might feel well, but we can't see the threats coming. Condition yellow, relaxed awareness, is where we are going through life. We're watching what we eat. We're paying attention to our physical activity. We're taking our medication on time. And we're checking our blood glucose by whatever method as negotiated with our diabetes care team so that we can see threats coming long before they have any danger to us and we can take appropriate action. Condition orange, a specific threat, triggers our full attention. That's when you get something like ketones. You may be feeling a bit sick. Your blood glucose has gone above your normal range. Now, what are you going to do about it? You need to focus on it until you get to a stage where you can go back to condition yellow, a stage of relaxed awareness. Condition red, that's when maybe you're nauseous in the context of ketosis, or you have hypoglycemia developing, you can feel the adrenaline being released. What are you going to do? Are you going to address it, or are you going to say, I'll get to it just now? And then obviously you end up in a big problem if you don't. So I think these lessons from self-defense, self-awareness can help us in our daily lives and journeys with a chronic condition, just to live in a state of relaxed awareness, but always being able to respond to and avoid threats. So many of us go into normalcy bias or optimism bias because we can't handle the prospect of something bad happening to us. A more useful way is actually say, well, let's try and avoid that at all costs. I don't know what you think about that, Stan.
I think that diabetes comes naturally or intuitively in terms of the management for many people. But for most people that I see in day-to-day clinical practice, those nudges, that kind of reminding and imploring people to make themselves more aware of where you are, what's coming down the road, what could happen, and ways to mitigate those risks is always going to be important. So your message is a fantastic one there, Michael.
Thank you, Stan. We now are ready to bring our studio guest into the fore, and it's with great pleasure that we welcome Mark Savory to this podcast. Well, I personally have known Mark for many, many years. Mark holds a Master of Science in Genetics from the University of KwaZulu-Natal, and I've known him in his role as a multi-awarded marketing executive, patient advocate, patient support program, and product launch specialist working in the pharmaceutical industry, specifically in the field of diabetes and related comorbidities. So having said that, Mark, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into the professional side of diabetes care from that side of the fence, and a little bit more about yourself and your interests.
Hi, Michael and Stan. Thank you for the opportunity to chat with you. Firstly, in terms of my journey in diabetes, it started in 2003, many years back, when I was basically appointed as an insulin rep in pharma. And it was quite an interesting thing for me. I had no clue what I was about to embark on. And I was excited about the fact that I could get to engage with people living with diabetes and obviously get to be able to do my work I was asked to do. And it was probably the most exciting and invigorating part of my life. If I look at my entire career, that is the period that stands out the most. And it's mainly because of the amazing insights I got from people living with diabetes and how much I learned about diabetes, but also it started the passion that I developed for diabetes over the years. And the key area was to try and understand what people were really grappling with to be able to address this condition. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I'm quite an educated guy. I think I've done well. And I think I have good understanding of things. And so I've got this. It's pretty easy to understand what these people living with diabetes are going through. And I think it was like 150 interviews or chats later that I realized there's just a huge disconnect. I'm not getting it. I'm not understanding why many of them are making the choices they're making and why they're still battling to get their glucose levels to where they need it to be. So I was trying to figure this one out and I couldn't understand it. It just, the penny wouldn't drop. But I was still quite excited about the journey and it drove that passion. And I said, look, it's where I want to stay. I resisted lots and lots of offers that came my way to go away from diabetes and do marketing in other areas. I'm totally passionate about diabetes and cardiovascular disease, and I'm going to stay in this area. And I think it was only later, a lot later, that things turned for me in terms of the understanding.
Mark, very often people who are put onto insulin in the doctor's office are anxious. In those days, before the wide proliferation or availability of diabetes nurse specialists, you know, you would phone up an industry representative, and as you alluded to, they would come along perhaps in your own practice, or in those days, they were still allowed to travel and might have even done it in the member's house to start an insulin treatment. Did you have a sense that there was still a degree of resistance or anxiety? Perhaps there wasn't enough time at the doctor's office to understand insulin. What was your sense of onboarding insulin in people who we would have, you know, regard as insulin naive, never having had access to it before?
So it was a range of responses, Stan. I think there were those who were accepting of the option that they were being put on, and they were then willingly, after some education in terms of how it works and everything else, would then gladly go onto it. But the vast majority would have this form of resistance from, I have no idea why my doctor decided that I needed this particular treatment option. I think I need to go to a different doctor. And so in those instances, it was often very difficult to be able to take the person through where they are now and how they got there and what was going to really be the journey forward if you didn't follow the options available to you now. And quite frankly, a lot of that was the hardest part of what I had to do, but it was the most stimulating because it was able to get that point across that you need to go down this road now to be able to manage and get those levels that you need to achieve on your glucose. And I must say, bar one person living with diabetes, I was able to get through to pretty much everyone else that I chatted with. I still, and this is the thing, you still remember the one person. That person stays very clear in your head because it's the one person you are not able to connect with appropriately.
What do you think were the skills that enabled you to connect with so many people so effectively? And what do you think was the barrier in that one person? Have you got any sense of what that could have been?
So I think the skill was trying to understand the person or the people that you were chatting with and understand where they were in that moment in their journey. And what was also the hook in terms of what was important to them, what was critical to them. And most often it was family. And if you could get that and understand and show them that actually this is okay, there is a journey that's going to give you an opportunity to just continue as you would normally. This is the journey we need to show you. The one person would not get away from basically blaming himself to say this is a problem and then just totally ignoring it. So that ostrich in the sand effect just stayed there. And while he was fully aware in terms of your color scheme, he just chose to ignore it, put his head in the sand. And the scary thing about it is he had an amazing family with young kids who would have benefited from him being more motivated. So that was the unfortunate thing in terms of being able to understand and say, I need to now move forward and manage this.
What I'm hearing here is something interesting, and I'm just reflecting on this because you don't see this very often. Michael mentioned it in the brief bio, Mark, that you come from this really rigorous scientific background, you know, masters, that's not an easy thing to attain. You get into the pharma industry and you're not just dealing at a molecular level. You're actually sitting in the house teaching somebody how to inject based on insulin treatment. And that's a rare thing in the South African pharma industry where people come out with their masters and their PhDs straight into the pharma side of things. You've had an excellent journey, and I too have known you for 20 years plus at this point in time. What's happened to the pharma industry in South Africa, looking from all sides? Because there's another side that you're going to tell us about a little bit later. But has pharma industry changed in respect to diabetes as time has gone on? Are things better? Are things not much better?
It's a good question, Stan. I think the industry has changed quite a lot. Previously, if we looked at pharma industry, the focus was very much on product, the products and what the products could offer, the benefits. very little of that was translated into the person who was going to be taking those products. And what was the value add for that person? What was the impact on that person? How did that person feel about taking these products? So what we're seeing is an evolution now towards a focus where you're putting the people living with diabetes, for example, at the center of everything that you do and everything that you focus on. So whether you're putting a marketing plan together, whether you're launching a product, you're putting that person in the center and saying, how am I able to touch that patient? Obviously, we as pharma are not able to work with patients. We work with our customers who are doctors. So how are we to get through to the patients by working with the doctors? And so a lot of the work is being done in that background area, a lot more focus on education and awareness. So we find that we do a lot of that. And even when you look at companies that are either in the multinational space or in the generic space across the board, all of them are coming on board with education. They're realizing the importance of education. And I think that has now become central to whatever we do to make sure, are we able to get the person living with diabetes to understand the significance of taking these particular medications that we bring to the market?
It's a very positive thing to hear, Mark. Really glad to hear that.
Sure.
In 2015, your life took a turn. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so 2015 was quite an interesting period in my life. I must say I was absolutely enjoying my journey in the pharma world, but I'd taken on quite a lot. I was probably working between 12 and 16 hours a day, pretty much 7 days a week. Wasn't really paying attention to me as a person. I wasn't paying attention to my body or anything. And I started to feel really bad. I was tired all the time. And I just put it down to working long hours, which was understandable. The hours were crazy. That's it. But I was spending a lot of time going to the toilet and I was just not great. Mm-hmm. So I thought, let's just go and do a checkup. As a person working in this industry, I'm not very good at actually going and doing a regular checkup. So I thought, let me do this. And I go and do this checkup and I got quite a bit of an interesting result from my physician. He said, I need to send you for more tests, but I'm pretty sure you have diabetes. So that was quite an interesting thing. And I was, no, he can't be right. I'm just very stressed and I'm very tired and everything else. And he eventually diagnosed it properly. And I did, Michael, what you said there in the beginning. I did the ostrich thing. And I just simply buried my head in the sand. Now, this is someone who's educated, understands this journey very well.
Right.
Just buried my head in that sand and just focused, ignored it and focused harder on my work. And didn't take the prescription, didn't fill it at all, threw it in the bin and walked away from his advice. And yeah, that was quite an interesting response from me. And when I look back on it now in hindsight, and I think now I can connect with those people living with diabetes. Now I know how to connect with them because there was something missing back then. I didn't understand the journey they were going through emotionally. And it's that emotional journey that I now started to engage with.
Wow.
That all changed in 2017. So I went through 2 years of just totally ignoring the fact that I needed to manage my diabetes. And in 2017, I was working down in Durban, seeing some clients in a hospital, sitting in a waiting room. It's what we do as industry quite a lot. And my blood glucose levels dropped. And it dropped significantly. And I just kept ignoring it because I didn't understand this feeling. But I could feel something was going wrong and I wasn't feeling great. And then I thought, okay, I need to go down to the cafeteria and just maybe grab something to eat because I'm not feeling too good. And before I did that, the ladies in the room said, look, you don't look good. Let's just check what's happening with you. And they did a check on my blood glucose level and it was just below 3. And we obviously then addressed that, got some liquids in and managed it. And I was okay. So I thought, okay, that's fine. That's just an anomaly. I didn't pay attention to the fact that I was hungry. I should have eaten. And I was relaxing that evening with my family and we had dinner together and I wasn't feeling good again. But this time around, I felt like I just wanted to sleep. I just want to close my eyes and lie down. And I was just totally exhausted. I could not keep my head up. And my father-in-law is a person living with diabetes as well. And he says, I'm just going to check your glucose levels. And he did that. And it was sitting at about 28. And that's when I realized there's something wrong. And my body's telling me I need to fix it now. I need to address it. I went back to the doctor when I got back to Johannesburg, and we went through the whole process of now starting to look at options that I had to basically get my levels to optimum. So that was quite an interesting journey, but it gave me huge insights into what people living with diabetes were actually going through, because now I started to understand I am one of them and I need to take over now in terms of making sure my levels were perfect.
Just for people out there listening, you were in a no man's land for 2 years, essentially denying your state, your condition. What do you think could have shortened that period for yourself and maybe for others in a similar situation? And what led you to change? Yes, the high blood glucose, but there must have been some other switch that was thrown at that stage. I'd be interested to hear what that is.
So the interesting thing is that when I look back at it, my thinking and my rationale was, well, if I do have diabetes and if my glucose levels are elevated, I'll be able to manage this with diet and exercise. I'll manage this with lifestyle changes. And that's what I did. But actually, those changes were not good enough. Okay. And they were not consistent. Mm. And it came out in 2017 when I realized that I was doing it just too intermittently to manage it. I needed to either be more effective in and consistent in what my option was there, or actually combine it with the treatment option that the doctor was offering. And when I look back at it, I mean, the treatment option was very simple. You know, it was just oral medication. So it was very easy. I didn't understand why I rejected it. I think I rejected just the concept that I had diabetes. Mm. That was what I rejected more than anything else.
I think it's important for our listeners to understand that you didn't fail in your lifestyle attempts, that you weren't good enough, let's say. It's that your physiology was at a point where no matter what you did, even if you did it every single day, would never have been able to compensate for the things that were wrong with the physiology, and that the medication almost helps that lifestyle change to be more effective. I think that's quite important that you didn't fail yourself. You just needed the help.
Sure. Absolutely.
Speaking of help, Mark, when you returned after those 2 years, did you find that the care you received was non-judgmental, or were you kind of fingered out and said, listen, you know, you should have been here 2 years ago and this is on you, and stamping and shouting? Because that can make or break, in my mind's eye, the kind of management that pursues when this person has had their Damascus moment, as you did, and for many people with diabetes. I'm interested to know what happened from the provider point of view.
The doctor that I saw was really incredible. She was very understanding of my journey up until that point where I was, totally supportive. And what was nice is that she recommended a very good program in terms of not just taking medication, but also in terms of changing things that I was doing.
Wonderful.
Especially relating to my work, etc. I must say, though, it was something very interesting that actually changed a lot of the management, and that was CGM.
So just for our listeners, that's continuous glucose monitoring. If anyone doesn't know, continuous glucose monitoring is a little patch you put on your arm generally, and that measures your glucose levels continuously without the need for constant finger pricks. Sorry about that, Mark. Carry on.
No problem. Thank you. So I was fortunate enough a year later to be working in an environment where I could have access to CGM for a short period of time. And I decided while I was doing the lifestyle changes, I was still seeing that my levels were not great. I was struggling with my glucose levels. So I decided to try CGM for 3 months and put it on. So what I realized is that I needed to individualize the protocol, especially relating to the diet that I was having. I needed to individualize it very well. Even though I had professionals advising me on how to do this and what to eat and everything else, and I stuck to that as a scientist, I stuck to that rigidly. I have a wife who's an expert in catering, so you can imagine everything was done to the T. But I would still have in the morning going into the office, I'd have my glucose levels go up to 15, 16, despite that. Mm. And I only picked it up because I was on the CGM. I then tailor-made it to ensure that I had the right combination of foods, etc., that allowed my levels to stay in range. And I must say, it took 3 months. It showed me amazingly the kind of impact that my lifestyle was having on my glucose levels. And I was able to make a note of all of those things that impacted negatively, all of those things that impacted positively, and get a good balance. And now I believe I'm on a good path. I still drop off that part occasionally, and that's not a problem at all. I can manage that.
Mark, you've then come full circle. You've had the scientific knowledge. You applied that knowledge in the field. You were then diagnosed as a person living with diabetes. Now you're involved in the advocacy movement. And I think that's something worth exploring, because this evolution of your own journey now couples all of these strands that have kind of been melded into advocacy. So where does the advocacy journey start? And tell us about that.
Yes, thanks. It's actually an amazing opportunity. And I really want to give a shout out to SA Diabetes Advocacy, Bridget McNulty and Kirsten. They do an amazing job. And I was fortunate enough to cross paths with them. And I realized I've always wanted to, and I think Michael and I have chatted over the years, I've always wanted to find out how can I give back and how can I actually assist my fellow people living with diabetes? How can we walk this journey together and I can impart my experience and my knowledge in that way? And I think SA Diabetes Advocacy gives me that platform to be able to do that. Mm. It also helps me to take the expertise that I have and say, can I use that? Can I also look at the connectiveness of this movement to be able to help other individuals as well to manage their diabetes? So I think the other problem we do face is that there's a lot of people who work in decision-making positions who unfortunately don't understand the journey fully. And often a lot of the lobbying that we need to do needs to happen at that level where we need them to understand the journey of people living with diabetes. The lived experience is very critical for them to understand. And they need to then be able to make the correct decisions, especially looking at things like medication. If we look at the state sector, one of the projects I'm working on is patients who are intolerant to metformin or have nasty side effects on it and therefore end up discontinuing their treatment. And while we're not able to fully quantify that level of a problem in the state, we know it exists. And even in my opinion, even if it's a handful of patients, if it's 5% or 10% of patients, these patients still need some option to be able to make sure that they can manage their diabetes and get the glucose levels they need to get. Mm. But there's no option to things like extended release, metformin, et cetera. So those are the kind of projects that I'm working on to say, can I get people who are in positions of authority to understand the journey that these people are going through and be able to change the decisions they make and not focus purely on cost, for example, which is one of the major barriers we deal with. So the journey has been excellent. I'm new in the journey, so I'm enjoying it. And I think we definitely are going to be able to move forward and do a lot of different things. The other area that I'm looking at is also my experience with CGM. Could we look at that experience being expanded and scaled up to, for example, other people living with type 2 diabetes, either in the initial diagnosis or when they are finding it difficult to keep their glucose levels down where they need it to be? Could we use that as an intervention to be able to motivate them to manage it?
Yes, certainly. In your anecdotal explanation of what CGM provided for you, I think there's quite a powerful reason for us to explore greater use of CGM within people with type 2 diabetes. I think we've got to be very careful in diabetes and healthcare not to necessarily only look at cost, but look at cost effectiveness over time. We get caught up in how much something costs, but if we look at the opportunity costs that are lost from not engaging in a possibly more expensive therapy, you may come up with a very different answer.
Sure.
I think if I take some messages home from today, it's as follows. Education remains the cornerstone of diabetes management, whether it be for the person with diabetes, the people involved in their care, whether it be at home or in their professional lives, and the people who provide that care, such as the healthcare workers. So we've seen that clearly in Mark's journey here. Self-education, his change, his Damascus moment, and the benefits that accrued from that. Mm. The second thing is change is inevitable. And at a point in time, whether it's driven by symptoms or unfortunately a complication or an illness, or just that intrinsic motivation when you've crossed, Michael, as you say, that normalcy bias, that level in the sand, there is inevitably going to be change. We've spoken at length about that over the podcast, how treatments, for example, change from early years to the later years and eventual possibly withdrawal of treatment in certain population groups. And then lastly for me is time. This is not something that's done of a day. And if the person with diabetes is going to be at the driving seat, you don't have to do everything at the first visit and put them on insulin and give them their test and put them to the dietitian and have them see the podiatrist. It needs to be done over a time period at their pace with them in the driving seat. And if those things, education, change, and time can come together, you're going to have a good, safe journey, allowing for the best possible health to emerge as needed.
Absolutely. Mark, any take-home message? When you compare and contrast your experience as a professional working in the farm industry to someone with lived experience, what's the take-home message you would like to leave our listeners, both healthcare professionals and people with diabetes?
I look at it, three areas, three stakeholders. One, if we're looking at the industry, for example, who play a pivotal role in providing treatment options that are vital for people living with diabetes. I think it's important to continue to put these persons at the center of everything that you do and continue to focus on how you can actually improve that, because ultimately it's that lived experience that will determine the outcome in terms of where these people want to go in their journey. Mm-hmm. In terms of healthcare practitioners, I think there needs to be a little more personalized and individualized in terms of the treatment options, etc. And don't just assume that once you've given that treatment option, that that person is now all fine and everything's going well. Continue to monitor and do the checks that need to happen. And one of the things I found is that motivation that Stan talks about, it's not always there. Sometimes it falls away. And it's those times where a person living with diabetes needs support. They need someone to support them. Mm. They need to know, okay, let me reach out. And it's great to have groups like SA Diabetes Advocacy who can actually offer us that kind of support. And that's the point that I'm alluding to in terms of people living with diabetes, is that there's always someone there to be able to assist. So don't think that you are walking on this journey alone. Reach out if you're not sure, because there's always someone who's had an experience that you can relate to, and you can then basically grab on that and move forward with your journey, as it were. So stay positive. For me, I'm enjoying the journey. I'm loving it. You know, I stay positive and focused on what I can control and manage from my side. And the rest, if I do it correctly, is going to be fine.
Some wonderful words of wisdom from you, Mark. As always, we focus on lived experience of people with diabetes as a teaching medium for our listeners. We focus on real people who have real stories, who can provide us with real answers. And I think, Mark, you have packed this show with so many insights that we all need to be aware of to support people living with diabetes and the people that support you.
Our guests are inspirational.
Absolutely.
No two guests' story, Michael, is the same, but that tenacity, that fighting spirit to enhance their health and well-being, if not right from the get-go, then at a point when it's right for them to make that move and to enjoy the best health and well-being. Mark, it's been fabulous having you here with us today. Mm. As Michael said, tremendous insights. We hope to continue our relationship with you for another 20 years on this journey.
Awesome. Thank you so much. I do appreciate the invite and certainly look forward to that continued collaboration. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Stan. And thank you, listeners, for sharing your valuable time with us. We really appreciate it. If you like what you hear on this podcast, please share it widely. This is a free education service. We are hoping to change as many lives as possible. We can only do it with your help. We're very grateful to the Listen app, that is LISTN, as we alluded to earlier in the show, for including us in their vast stable of great media brands, and we hope that it'll improve your ability to engage with us going forward. So we'll look forward to being with you again next week. Over and out from us. Thank you for joining us on Not Artificially Sweetened, where we aim to build bridges of insight and understanding between people with diabetes and the health professionals that facilitate their care. Anything we discuss is for your reflection, education, personal growth, and entertainment only. You join this podcast at your own risk, and we are not responsible for any omissions, errors, or unwanted medical outcomes. Please note the following important, specific disclaimers. For people with diabetes, the health professionals on this podcast are not your personal caregivers. Always discuss any new information with your diabetes team before acting on any aspect of it. The views and opinions discussed are those of the hosts only and do not represent those of any other entity. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you encounter in this session. Anything you learn or experience here cannot substitute for personalized, professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. For health professionals working in diabetes, always discuss any new information with your clinical team before acting on any aspect of it. You are personally accountable and liable for any choices made in a clinical setting according to your level of training and legal scope of practice. Any information or insights gained here must be used with your professional discretion and with the developing base of clinical evidence, local and organizational laws, regulations, guidelines, and protocols. Good luck with your diabetes care missions. Till next time.